The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And it's great to have you back on the program. Good morning to you. It is the 9 till noon show and the lines are open for you to stay in contact with us. You can WhatsApp, text or send your voice notes on WhatsApp to 0860 25000. Give us a call on 07491 25000, or if you prefer, you can email comments at highlandradio.com. Now, just to remind you and ask you, and I've been told that I need to really start begging. We're asking you to support us, support the Cancer Care West Donegal. They have an office in Letterkenny providing amazing services for people with cancer, those that have got a diagnosis, those that are going through treatment, and then offer a range of supports for those post-treatment. And just to call in and chat, and you never know when any of us might need those kind of facilities. And we're trying to raise awareness so that more people who maybe are struggling with a diagnosis or their treatment process and want some support or to engage with other people, we're encouraging them to avail of the use of the services in Letterkenny. It's a beautiful environment. We were up there and we were so moved by it and the stories of people and the staff that work there that we're trying to, through the 9 till noon show, I'm trying to raise a few euro for them. And with that in mind, we're taking part in the Donegal Camino. We're joining on Monday, where we're going to walk in Ards. Donal will be presenting the show. Hopefully we'll be able to link in if the technology works and all that kind of stuff. But we would love to be able to say that we, as a family of the 9 till noon show, have raised a certain amount of money for them. And I'd really love if you could, if you've any spare money, to back us on that. You can do so by giving us a call at the radio station whilst we're on air here. If you want us to help you process that, that's no problem at all. 07491 25000. You can go directly to our fundraising page. It's idonate.ie/GregHughes. Or if you want to drop something up to us here, we log it and put your name with it as well on the website. Now, we've a lovely wee figure there. It would be lovely as the week progresses if we could build that up. And I guarantee you that that money is going directly to Cancer Care West to provide supports and services for people here in Donegal, ourselves, our family, and so on and so forth. So if you want us to process it for you, give us a call, 07491 25000. Or if you want to do it yourself directly, idonate.ie/GregHughes. Or drop something into us. It would be greatly appreciated. And all of your very hard-earned money, if you've got some to spare, and I wouldn't ask anyone who didn't to donate, goes directly to that brilliant charity. All right, on to some of your comments now. Schools are expected to teach more Irish and counteract online misogyny, but recent surveys show that many schools struggle to find qualified teachers to deliver an already crammed curriculum within our education system. It needs to match expectations within resources. But let's see, surely maybe it's time to sort of look at the resources and say, well, what's important here? What are we doing right that we should keep doing and maybe do more of? What are we doing wrong that's a waste of time and we could maybe revise that and put those resources elsewhere? I don't think anyone wants teachers to do more. We're not asking for teachers to raise our children either, don't get me wrong. But we have to make sure that they're fully supported and that their amazing time is used to the maximum. So I don't think we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We need to look at it and see what we can do better. Hi, Greg. If current government policy and future government policy continues on the same track, Irish language and our Irishness will be a memory. At the moment, we have 15-odd percent non-Irish living in this country. It's not an insignificant amount, but it's only 15%. That means 85% are Irish. Of those that are already here, born here, live here, and what have you, I'll get the percentages for you, but a small percentage of them choose Irish. Now, they'll celebrate Irishness, and you'll see them, you know, we celebrate Irishness and everything about it, but we choose not to use the Irish language. That's on us. That's really on the 85%. I mean, we can sort of blame the people coming into the country, or the 15%, and that's a separate, I'm not talking about immigration policy as a whole, right? But it's not their fault that people who live here and have lived here all their lives aren't speaking Irish. So, I mean, that's the language. Irishness, maybe, where I always think we're quite a, we've got a, always had a rich tapestry of opinion and culture here because of the amount of time we travelled. Greg, it's so refreshing to listen to Barbara and your own Shannon. Our Irish language is unique and special. Please don't get rid of it. That comes in from Mary. The Irish language is not who we are now, believes a listener there. If you've ever been in Scandinavia or Holland, you'll notice how many of the children and general population has perfect English as well as their native tongue. Why doesn't our government learn from others on how to teach languages? Because the teaching of languages in Ireland is awful. Learning verbs, nouns, etc., where the other countries don't focus on that. They focus on general conversation and the rest follows, and we've had that. We've had that conversation for years and years and years. It seems to be what the people want. You know, let's not worry about spelling and sentencing and even writing. Let's just focus on using the language, get it to be a living language. And as this listener rightly points out, the rest might follow. A caller believes Irish should be compulsory. Concentrate on teaching Irish through conversation and forget the poetry and essays. The core needs to be taught at primary school. Lots of children go into secondary school with little or no Irish. And that's despite the best efforts of the great school I went to quite some time ago, as you can imagine. I don't think anyone, unless there was Irish being spoken at home all the time, I don't think anyone transitioned from sixth class in national school into first year in the tech with any level of fluency in Irish from the education. Good morning, Greg. I agree with Barbara talking about learning Irish. My granddaughter learned Irish in baby infants class. The teacher was fluent. She was speaking and learning Irish words and sentences and loved it. Unfortunately, after that year, it stopped. She's now going into fifth class and Irish is never mentioned. Thank you. Another, why don't schools who use transition year to go off to Paris and Italy use those trips to go to the Gaeltacht and embrace and encourage the Gaelic language instead of foreign languages? And I'm not sure really, though, the travel to Paris or Italy is about languages. I mean, obviously you get to see some of the culture, but a lot of it is, you know, particularly like Garda, for example. You go over there and eat pizzas in the hotel and go on water parks and go to shopping centres. So I'm not sure there's any benefit in that in terms of learning a language. Last one before we take the bingo numbers. I agree 100% with Barbara. It's about time Irish people took a bit of pride in our own native language. I walked the length of Letterkenny Street on St. Patrick's Day. I heard a great variety of languages. No Irish, though, except any greetings between myself and anyone I met. Irish should remain compulsory and exemptions have been dished out, not always benefiting the children. More emphasis on the spoken language is needed. I found that children were very quick to pick up the language through drama as Gaeliger, which is an interesting point. Again, another way of looking at it. And I just want to play a request, finally. Can you please give best wishes to Sally and Desi Foy? They're in Ballybuffet, who are 59 years married today. Congratulations, Sally and Desi. That's a wonderful milestone to reach. Lots of love from Maggie and also all of us here on the 9 till noon show. So if the coming autumn and winter follow the pattern of recent years, another spike in respiratory syncytial virus can be expected. It's RSV, effectively. We know it more commonly, leaving many children with a potentially serious illness. But for the first time, a jab to protect newborns from the virus will be offered before discharge from maternity hospitals. Right. So Elizabeth joins us on the programme now. Elizabeth, good morning to you.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing good. I suppose you are backing parents to sort of get this vaccine. Before we talk about that, maybe why is this such an important subject for you, Elizabeth?
So I had Grace on the 1st of December last year. She was 6 weeks early, so she was a premature. She's my fourth, but she was my first one to be premature. We stayed in the hospital for a little while, and then she got home here with the kids. Now, obviously, with three other kids in winter time, they're all elder, and one in school and one in preschool. Mm. There's colds, there's doses, there's everything, and you've done your best, of course, to protect her, because everyone said to me she's premature, so she is more vulnerable. But on the 20th of December, the nurses come out to check her, and public health nurse, and felt that she was jaundiced yet again, and she wasn't back at her birth weight, so we should go to the GP. So we went to the GP, and he said to us on the Thursday, so it was the 21st of December, that we would need to go out to the hospital. We went out to the hospital to get her checked over. She had no cough. You know, when people think of like RSV, you think, oh, they're going to be coughing or runny nose or high temperature. She had none of that. We went to the hospital, out to NE, and I can hand my heart say that we were meant to be at the hospital when Grace really deteriorated quite quickly. We went in through, we got quickly seen in through the back. Her oxygen levels were low. We met a nurse in the A&E, a paediatric nurse called Aoife and Niamh, And they very quickly realised how sick Grace was. Grace was on my chest, and I still remember Aoife saying to me, if you just want to pop her onto the bed there, Anne will pop off her cardigan. Mm. And as I put Grace down onto that bed, she went blue.
Oh, no.
And we, within minutes, there was, I think it was 11 nurses and doctors around Grace. They were frantically trying to get her stable. And they quickly done the swabs that they do to check to see what it was. And the lab came back and said that it was RSV. So they knew then what they were dealing with. They'd done chest x-rays and lung x-rays and all of that. And they couldn't get, she was tiny. She was 4 pounds 14 when she was born the 1st of December. This is the 21st of December and she still wasn't back at that. So I think that day she was maybe like 4 pounds 5.
Oh, we don't.
So she was tiny. So they couldn't get, you know, they couldn't get a line, and she was so dehydrated. I suppose because she was my first premature, even though she was my fourth, she was very, very sleepy, and that's probably now what I know was the sign.
Mm-hmm. Lethargic,
but I thought because she was premature, everyone said to me, all premature babies, they sleep more because they're not supposed to be born yet. Yeah. Like, she wasn't due until the 7th of January. So that's why I thought she was so sleepy. So she never tried to fight it at all. So we arrived at Letterkenny at the hospital about 5 o'clock, and at just after 7:30, the doctor rang Crumlin and Trenfield Street to see who would take her, and that they needed her gone quickly, as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So thankfully, the National Neonatal Transfer Programme were in Crumlin, or were in Dublin, where they're based, and were ready to go. So they came up the road to Letterkenny as quickly as they could to take her away. Letterkenny managed to get her stable twice. While they had her stable twice, she became really, really ill again. We were still in A&E. And then the anaesthetic and our anaesthetist doctor, he decided that she needed to be moved out of A&E because it just wasn't suitable for her. So they moved her up to off to one of the theatre suites, to be close to ICU there on the top floor. So we went up there. It was about, I think it was about 10:30 by the time they managed to, because they went to move her, and then she became really unstable again. And even like, you know, when they were trying to get a line into her, they couldn't. They were going to shave her head to try and get a line into her scalp and stuff. It was awful. So she was moved off there, and then we waited for that team to come. And like, Letterkenny, I will say, the guests can hear her making noise now.
Don't worry about that. Yep.
They get such a hard time and such a hammering, but they literally kept her alive until that team came. She was on CPAP, which is like non-invasive ventilation. Mm-hmm. And then once the team came, they arrived just a couple of minutes before midnight, and the team in Letterkenny were clock watching because they were so out of their depth with her. She was so sick. And you know, inevitably, they're not, okay, they're specialised, obviously, in paediatrics and sick children, but not to the extent that, you know,
they were keeping her oxygenated and alive until the people with the very specific specialities in that area got there.
Yeah.
I mean, that was amazing life-saving work, like.
Yeah, oh, without a doubt. And when they arrived into that theatre suite, I'll never forget it, you could see every single doctor, nurse in Letterkenny Hospital just go, they're here.
Exhale,
and they came in. Yeah. And they ventilated her then. I said to the girl, I said, like, Dublin's so far away. She's not going to make it to Dublin. Like, she's so sick. And she said, if I thought she wouldn't make it to Dublin, I would not take her, she said.
Wow.
But I am going to have to ventilate her. She said, I will ventilate her. So she ventilated her in Dublin, and we got her christened quickly before she left. And they ventilated her, or they ventilated in Letterkenny.
How did that conversation go, just about the christening before she left, Elizabeth?
So my cousin is actually a midwife in Letterkenny, and she had come to be with us.
Yeah.
And she had said to me, she said, Elizabeth, how do you feel about this funny story? Actually, how do you feel about her getting christened? You know, is this something you want to do? And I said, oh, goodness, yeah. I said, definitely. So we had rang then the local church of Ireland minister there in Letterkenny. Yeah. At the time, and she said that she would come in and do it, and she didn't. You know, she couldn't get anywhere near. There were so many machines on her. She was doing this thing called sleep apnea, where she was holding her breath.
Oh, right.
And then they would, and they would start, because she was just so exhausted. Her body was so exhausted. She was holding her breath, and they would start shaking her and calling her and saying, "Grace, Grace, you know, Grace," to try and get her to take a breath again. So the minister came in then. It was really, really late. We thought we wouldn't get through to her. So she had come in then and she christened her then. So it was, you know, and we stood around. We got her christened here at church locally.
But did you do that sort of in the knowledge, Elizabeth, that she might not come through this? That was presumably the motivation for the early christening, which is a reality check that maybe you didn't need at that time but was important too. Or maybe it gave you comfort.
Yeah.
Depends on the individual.
We knew, we knew that she was really, really sick. Mm. We knew that she was so sick, and we knew the fear. You know, when you see doctors and they are really scared, and nurses, and, you know, the most of them were supposed to finish their shift at 8 o'clock. They all stayed with us until half two until she left. You know, we knew the fear in them that she was really, really, really ill. She was so, so tiny. And this, and we hear, you know, we hear of a virus, an RSV, and, you know, we say it quite lightly, but it's deadly.
The problem with the RSV is it depends on the child. There's no, it's so random, and that's why it's unpredictable. But it's very, it potentially very dangerous for anyone under one or children aged 1 to 4. There's other categories as well, like if you've got lung or heart conditions at whatever age you are. But it spreads all over the place, but it just really hits some really, really tough. So you just, She, thank God, Grace gets down to Crumlin, and there unfolds two weeks effectively of intense care.
Yeah, so Grace left Letterkenny at, it was just before 2:30. We saw her off because she was going, she was in the ventilator, and she was on, it's not an ambulance, but it looks like an ambulance, but it's basically a paediatric ICU in wheels. And they're amazing. There were 6 of them in the back of her and the driver. We weren't able to go with her then, so we followed after them, and she was down in Crumlin within like 2 hours. They rang to say she was in Crumlin, and we followed after. So this is now the 22nd of December.
Before you get to that, I want to talk about the journey. Sorry, because I'm kind of a because we went through this with Hudson, not like you did, but effectively his life was saved in that hospital when he was born. That's just the bottom line, and he got an amazing care, and it was touch and go. There's no doubt about that for a while, but I'm just trying to imagine if you're following down this ambulance, like, was it in, did they fly on ahead, or was it in your sight the whole time? Or were you, like, you'd be dreading that maybe you saw it pulled over the side of the road or something? I just can't imagine what that journey must have been like.
So we were in, when they arrived into that theatre street in Letterkenny, and they had gotten her, we'd come out so they could ventilator and do all of that, and they got her settled, and they said, what are you doing? And I said, oh, we're going straight after you. I said, she's not getting out of my sight. And my poor husband Gavin had been, you know, we'd been sobbing, we'd been on the floor, we'd been just in bits for hours at this stage, and he just left exhausted. And the driver said to me, he said, please don't, please, please don't, he said, because I have seen so many parents across the country.
What a great call.
Try and follow me, he said, and they crash, they go off the road. He said, are you local? And we said, no, we're about 50 minutes away from Letterkenny for an hour. And he said, please go and rest for an hour.
Great call. What advice to get? Yeah, you really needed that then. That was brilliant.
And he said, please don't. So thankfully, my cousin who had been with us, she lives in Letterkenny, so she had come out to my house, lie down for an hour and a half, and then follow Grace. So we did. We went out to my cousin's house, and we were able to just, I don't even think we slept. We just sat there looking at each other in disbelief as to how the day had unfolded. And then we set off then and went off into Crumlin. And we were on the road, and Crumlin rang and said, she's here, she's stable. So when we got to Crumlin, she was in the ventilator. There was nothing that they could do. The ventilator was doing all the work for her. It was keeping her alive. And now it was just about letting those lungs recover. Mm-hmm. So on the 22nd, they'd done the first lung x-ray, one whole lung, and I can still see the picture in my head of the doctor showing us the lung. It was completely taken over by the virus, and the other lung, and again, it looked in the picture in the x-ray, it looked like it was massive. You can imagine how small her little lungs were. And her other lung then, it was like 3/3 of it were taken over.
And you know, you mentioned it earlier, Elizabeth, that we don't, the amount of energy, her just over 4 pounds, the amount of energy for her little body to try and to keep pulling on that partial lung effectively to stay alive. She must be some little battler. I know she had the help in the first instance, but she had to be battling hard herself to use all that energy up to try and maximise that small bit of lung she really had at her disposal at that time.
And as you know, and she was so, so dehydrated. So when they were pumping the fluids into her, and she was on, you know, they had her sedated to do the ventilation.
Yeah.
They moved a lot of the ventilator when they had moved her. It was down the nose, and then they put it down then the throat.
Mm-hmm.
And so they changed it when she got to the Crumlin. You know, she was on feed, she was on fluid, she was on morphine, she was on, I think it was like six pumps that she was wired up to in an ICU. But, you know, Letterkenny and Crumlin, they're so specialised. And in Letterkenny, they were so out of their depth. But, you know, they've done so amazing with her. And Crumlin are almost like, it's routine to them, you know. So we came into Crumlin that morning, and we were like, "Oh, you know, we were still very, you know, like, oh my goodness,
yeah,
like what's going on?" And they're like, "Oh, this is another baby. Well, yeah, we'll fix it, and then we'll get back out the door." And we're like, "Is she going to be okay?" And they're like, "Yeah, of course, she's going to be fine." And we're like, "But you've no idea what happened a couple of hours ago. Like, you know, they didn't obviously didn't see any of that." So then she was in on the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, and then we had these other three kids at home. So my husband came on back up home. To spend Christmas with them, and I stayed and spent Christmas in Crumlin. Great.
And when did you sort of start seeing the white smoke that, you know, I know they were reassuring you, and I love that confidence that they had, because as you say, they've seen this before.
Yeah.
But when did you sort of start seeing Grace rouse a little bit and recognise your daughter coming out of it?
Because this is a really funny one, because when you say that, when we left the theatre suite in Letterkenny and we walked, they took her down in the lift and we took the other lift, because I had an emergency section, so it was only like 3 weeks of post section.
Okay.
I know, like, just to add on.
Stick that in there, so, yeah, no bother. Don't tell me you got a little infection or anything, because that would just be...
I did.
Oh, get out of town, would you? Jeez.
But, it was awful. But,
right, go on.
We walked down, so they asked, the team that were taking her to come and asked if they could have the main door, you know how the main door closes in the hospital, like, can I? To get her out that, and rather than taking her back through A&E. So they said yes. So the security man opened up the main door, and we and Gavin stood at the main door, and they wheeled her into that ambulance. And the lady who was the transport coordinator, Carmel, who was lovely, Gavin had the empty car seat in his hand still, my husband Gavin, and the oxygen masks and everything. There was like, oh my goodness, there was so much stuff lying in it that had been thrown into it in A&E, because it was just, it was frantic.
Yeah.
And she said to Gavin, she put her hand on Gavin's arm and she said, "Now don't forget to take the empty car seat to Crumlin to take her home."
Mm.
And Gavin looked at me and goes, "She's going to come home, Elizabeth. She will come home. Wow. She just said she's going to go home." So there was almost a little bit, without her maybe Carmel realising what she had done there, it was like, she said she's going to come home. We're going to get to take her home.
Yeah.
So then by Christmas Day, they'd done another lung x-ray on Christmas Day. And they could see that the lungs were starting to come back quite well. And they were like, "We might start tomorrow to take down the oxygen or take down the ventilator."
Is that up there with one of the best Christmas gifts you've got?
Yeah. Because when they started to turn down the ventilator, she started to come out of the sedation a bit. And for the first time then, on St. Stephen's morning, Gavin came back down St. Stephen's morning, first thing to me. When we went to see her when ICU opened on St. Stephen's Day, she opened her little eyes when she heard our voice and you were like, "Oh my goodness." And it was the first time she'd opened them. But when they came around on St. Stephen's Day, they said then, you know, they said, I think, well, there's like a fine line, the ventilators. They don't want them really awake, but they don't want them really highly sedated. So they're like, "We're going to turn up her sedation just a wee bit, because she's kind of fidgeting a little bit and it can hurt them, you know, the ventilator can hurt them then." Yeah.
And there's the risk of pulling stuff out of themselves as well, of course. Accidentally.
So on the day after St. Stephen's Day, which was, I can't remember what day now that was, we'll say they thought about taking out the ventilator that day, because she was doing a lot of the breathing by herself then. But she was very, when the doctor came around, he was like, "No, to take it out." He was like, "No," he was lovely. He was like, "No, she's not. She's just not showing me signs that she wants to." He said, "She'll tell us when she wants the ventilator out." And I was thinking, "What are you talking about? Like, she can't tell you." So the following day, on the Thursday, when I went down and I was walking into ICU, I met the nurse and she was like, "Wait till you see her today." And I was like, "What?"
Oh, wow.
And Grace was shaking her head as if to say, "Get that thing off me." The dog's come around and he was like, "Yeah." He was like, "I think she's ready to get the ventilator out." So they took the ventilator out.
So he stayed in the CPAP for a while, I would say.
Yes. Yeah. No, she didn't go on the CPAP.
Really?
She went straight on to oxygen.
Okay, cool.
Thankfully, she didn't need the CPAP. We thought she was going to need the CPAP. But no, she went on to the oxygen. She stayed another day at the ICU. And then we were moved to the ward, then St. Peter's ward. And me and Grace stayed in St. Peter's ward in Crumlin then for another week. And they had thought about taking us back to, you know, Letterkenny, because I was on my own in Dublin then. Because Gavin came home to the other crew. But I was like, no, I'm fine. Like, it's fine. So we stayed then in Dublin then for another week, and she came home then on the 4th.
Did she gain much weight? Did she gain much weight over the couple of weeks, Elizabeth?
She did then. She started to get up then, closer back up. So she had lost then while she was in ICU and coming. She was down and under the 4 pounds again, 3.10. And then she started to climb then once we got back onto St. Peter's Ward, and I was feeding her, breastfeeding her myself. Yeah. So once I started to feed her again then myself, she started to climb then again through. And she's nearly 9 months now, the 1st of September. She's still toady, but she's doing great. She's trying to crawl around the house, and she's still tiny, but she did then start to gain. And Crumlin is an amazing hospital, but it's an awful place to be.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Just out of interest, before we talk about, I mean, I presume in Letterkenny, and also down in Crumlin, you took pictures, do you know, when she's all up to the machinery and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Do you look at them?
No.
Yeah. Have you looked at them yet?
I can't do it. I've tried.
It's just the reason I ask is because I have those photos of Hudson, and I just, even though thankfully he's such a healthy, annoying little boy.
I can't
look at those. I just can't look at those photos. And
you
I think I think it's because it was so distressful that
awful.
I can't sort of look at them and go, oh, that was bad, but now it's good. If I try to look at them, it's actually too. I find it actually too distressing. Yeah. So I was just curious if it was just a me thing, Elizabeth, or if you and Gavin were the same.
No, and even I'd be quite relaxed, mummy, but with, you know, in Crumlin you see other kids the same age as maybe my eldest are quite sick.
Yeah.
You know, on Christmas Day I was on my own. I was walking the corridor. It was really, really quiet, and I was walking the corridor because ICU closes for quiet time in Crumlin. I was walking the corridor and I met two undertakers coming. You see things that you really shouldn't see as well.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, and even then, like last week, Grace had a wee head cold, and I found myself like really overly panicking, even though it was only a head cold. But it was like, you know, well, this is what, you know, what if she gets really, really sick again? And she had a high temperature this time last week, and Gavin kept saying to me, but Elizabeth, the high temperature is a good sign. She's fighting it. Last time she didn't try and fight. At all, she had no
fight in her.
I'm
starting to see the roles in this relationship, Elizabeth. Do you know what I mean?
Poor Gavin. You know, there's so much that you'll probably over worry about. Yeah. And I was hoping that as she gets older, I'll be able to look at those pictures, but clearly not.
Oh, no, yeah, it's just an interesting. I presume a time will come. Yeah. But so the reason we're talking is in the context of this new RSV vaccine being available. It's at birth or before you leave hospital, and parents will be asked to give verbal consent to the immunisation. Now there is the reality is, and we're not going to get into it now, but there's been an awful lot of conversation about vaccines in recent years, and even going back 10 years. And unfortunately, let's forget COVID and go back to other vaccines. There was people that were making money out of putting parents off certain vaccines. And unfortunately, down the years then, kids have died or have become seriously ill because they didn't get those vaccines. And parents thought they were doing the right thing. But you're very keen, forgetting other vaccines and the controversy about it, RSV can be life and death. And we've a story where you've got wee Gracie in your arms and she's trying to crawl around the place, and but it was so close to being something else. It was so close to those undertakers you've seen coming into your room. And I'm not trying to upset anyone, but that's what we're talking about. And it's all with that in mind that you were keen to tell the story and encourage people to protect their children. It doesn't a lot of kids get RSV and it's fine, but for some, it gets sepsis, I think, isn't it?
It's that under 1 year old, isn't it? I think the vaccine's been rolled out between, if they're born between the 1st of September and it might be February, I think.
Well, we'll double check all that,
I think it's...
The new jab known as nirsevimab. Trust your medical practitioner. It'll be offered in maternity hospitals to all babies born from September 1st to the end of next February. So it's seasonal, obviously.
And the majority, as you say, the majority of children get RSV. And there was, I mean, Crumlin, when I was in ICU, was like, it was like a revolving door of children in with it. Majority of them were maybe like, you know, like 10 months, and they would come in, they would go on to the ventilator for a couple of days, they would get off it, they would go, you know, and that was inevitably it. Crumlin rang me back in, maybe March or springtime, and said that they were doing up a case study for the government to try and get this vaccine rolled out, and they were using Grace as one of the examples, because there were so many children who were supposed to get surgery done who were pushed back because Grace was taken up a bed in ICU. Mm. You know, there was other routine things that were being cancelled because there were so many children last year with RSV. It was awful. You wouldn't have believed it. And they actually said to me that Grace was without a doubt the sickest child with RSV in Crumlin last year who actually made it.
Unbelievable. It's not actually a vaccine. It's called a vaccine, but it's not a vaccine. It's antibodies that go directly into the baby and it protects them from that virus or lessen the severity of the infection for around 150 days. So whilst it's obviously, you know, a vaccine, it's not actually a vaccine, it's antibodies. And it's funny because I think it was the Christmas before last, Hudson then got RSV and that horrible situation where they get very lethargic and stuff, especially when they're a little bit older. Yeah. To some extent, it gives you more of an indication, but, you know, that sort of almost delirious. It was on Christmas Day and thankfully we spotted it early, got to Now Doc, met a lovely lady on Christmas Day. Wasn't on my to-do list that day, but gave us an antibiotic, an interim antibiotic, and then everything was fine after that. So, listen, it's great fun having kids, but it can be a nightmare as well. We can try and limit the nightmares as much as possible. And Grace is back, and Grace is doing well. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
If I thought that by me telling you about Grace, and she is here and she's fine, but what we went through that those days were horrendous. And if I thought I could encourage one parent to take it and hopefully protect them against it. I mean, Grace isn't going to get it this year. She's now 8 months, 9 months. And she'll probably pick up RSV this year with the others at school and in the night and all the rest of it. But, you know, I would hate for somebody to have to go through or see, and as we're joking about never looking at those pictures again, you know, the trauma that it's caused.
Oh, 100%. And that's the reason why not to. It's because of the trauma. It's real. That's just gone.
Yeah. She'll not remember a bit of it. And I mean, me and Grace are going to party this Christmas because we had no fun last Christmas. But, you know, if I thought one parent would take it and say, do you know what, if you're sitting on the fence about it, and if I was having a baby this year in Letterkenny and I was on the fence about it too, you would be on the fence because you really need to do it. But yeah, it's a deadly virus and it can have serious, serious issues for a little baby who can fight it off. And obviously they're not strong enough to fight it.
Right, so just to be just to back it up, it's called a vaccine, but it's antibodies, and we also can sort of rely on what happened in other countries. In Spain, for an example, 90% of newborns were immunized against RSV, and then the hospitalization rate amongst that group fell by over 80%. So that's a lot of wee graces that didn't put their parents through an absolute bloody nightmare. I'm delighted to hear everything's going well. And there were some lovely parts of that story. I think particularly Carmel telling Gavin to make sure to bring the baby seat and other stuff as
and
well.
And I will say when I'm here is that Letterkenny Hospital get an awful hammering, and I know they do, but I've had 4 children in maternity. I've been in A&E. She was in the neonatal. I was in the theatre for the section. She was in the theatre being looked after that night. They are and were amazing. They kept her alive, and without them having kept her alive for those hours, she wouldn't be here. They were frantic that night trying to keep her stable enough to get Crumlin to come and take her. Yeah. But they are amazing, absolutely.
Exactly. Like, I mean, I don't know. It depends on people's belief systems. Is there such thing as angels on earth? But I'll tell you, they're as close as you're going to get out and touch.
And they do. You hear people give out, but I have to say, to me and Gavin, they couldn't have been better to us. You know, I know they were focusing on Grace, but every now and again, they would come over and say, are you okay? You know, do you want something? You know, anything at all? Because they were fantastic. Yeah, they were fantastic. And even her christening was the other week here at home. We got her christened again at home in the church here locally. And one of the staff from the theatre actually came, landed with a card for her and a little note for Grace saying, I was there and held your mammy's hand when you were first christened, and I'm so glad to hear that you're getting christened at home with your family today.
Don't forget you, and I will say grace for that matter.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Elizabeth, listen, best wishes to you, Gavin, Grace and the other three. We really appreciate your time today. All right. Thanks so much.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. So that's Elizabeth's story. And ultimately, it's every parent's own decision. But this antibodies injection is available to all newborns now, born after the 1st of September. It's really seasonal. And it's antibodies that go into the baby and it protects them from the virus, or at least lessens the severity of the infection. It's been tried in Spain. And 90% of newborns there were immunised against RSV, and that led to a hospitalisation rate amongst those groups of newborns by over 80%, but also to presume there's a herd sort of a impact on that as well. Doreen Crossans, Women's Health Coordinator with the National Women's Council, and is with me now. Good morning to you. Thanks so much for your time.
No worries. Thanks for having me on.
Violence against women is at epidemic levels, with Women's Aid receiving over 40,000 disclosures of domestic abuse in 2023. There's a serious issue here, serious problem, isn't it? And we need to sort of get our heads around how we address this.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one of the reasons why NWC is calling for SPHE, which is obviously in primary schools and post-primary schools at the moment and has undergone a revamp in the past couple of years. So really that curriculum be mandatory both in primary schools and in post-primary schools, including senior cycle, because we know SPHE is a subject that can really do a lot in terms of transforming children and young people's perception of gender, of gender stereotypes, and also, you know, as you said, working towards combating violence against women and gender-based violence as well.
Yeah, and I still see, and I see some commentary on social media, that there seems to be a lot of people that don't want to accept this, and it seems to be particularly men, and they feel that this is an attack against men, and men, and get all defensive. And next thing you know, you're having threads of conversation about how poor men are being victimised or something along those lines. Like, men shouldn't feel threatened by this type of information, these conversations. They should actually accept that there is an issue, which there seriously is, and people can't deny that, and say as well, well, what kind of role do we have in this? Because this is unacceptable in any society. I mean, all you hear is about the potential imaginary dangers towards women and children. You've seen all that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is an actual problem that's been here for generations, right? We can't ignore it. We have to admit it's happening and see what we can do, as you've already outlined one measure, see what we can do to stop it happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, there has been concern over the past few years and a lot of misinformation around the SPHE curriculum. But really, the reality is that the update to the curriculum and the inclusion of relationships and sexuality education has gone through an extremely robust consultation process, which has engaged with young people, parents, you know, members of the community, school leaders, all of those key stakeholders. And really, there has been unanimous agreement among those people that, you know, children and young people deserve high quality relationships, sexuality education, which encompasses things like learning about healthy relationships, about consent, about, you know, developing a sense of personal responsibility, understanding your sexuality, personal growth, all of those topics. Yeah. So it's not about demonising men or anything like that. It's
no, of course not. And I think that is amongst adults who've already been through the school system, if you know what I mean. The thing about the SPHE is that, of course, whilst there was broad consultation, there's still a very little understanding of it. And I would argue that the majority of parents or guardians listening right now don't actually know what's in there or what is proposed. What might happen is still things that were suggested or perhaps were potentially going to be in it from years ago are still being touted as that's what's going to happen in our schools. So I would love to see, and I've said this before, I would love to see some sort of tool or information freely available to parents and guardians so they can see precisely what their children in what year will actually be taught and then make up their own minds based on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, you know, information should be widely available and, you know, it is, to be honest. I mean, the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment have all the public consultations available on their website. It includes all the draft specifications for the curricula and also has a lot of the toolkits and the resources that, you know, educators would actually be using to implement the new curricula. So absolutely, I think, you know, people want to be informed and that's their right. And really that information is broadly available. And one of the things that, you know, NWC is advocating for is that the implementation of SPHE should be a whole school approach, which really what that means is that it involves parents, it involves the communities, alongside obviously students themselves and other school stakeholders, because we really think for it to be successful, it has to be a process that is inclusive. And obviously the parent voice is important in that as well. But it's particularly the voice of the young people is what we want to be hearing. How are they finding the topics? You know, are there other opportunities for redevelopment? Do sections still need to be updated? You know, what's their feedback now that it's starting to be implemented?
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to have the debate now. The problem is there's quite a bit in the SPHE that a lot of parents don't want to be in there. And I just wonder if that could, if that is sort of is confusing the message for the wider benefits of such a program, if that makes sense. But as I say, that's a conversation perhaps for another day. Fundamentally, I mean, the headline is gender-based violence, which again, for some people, they freak out at that. Misogyny, the problem here we have primarily is male violence against women. Okay. And there are incredibly influential and powerful people who are making an awful lot of money over promoting misogyny, and we're not counteracting that well enough.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, what you're getting to there is obviously that most young people, children have smartphones, they have access to, you know, websites that maybe wouldn't be age appropriate, maybe that parents wouldn't want them to be seeing, and also influencers online who, you know, are maybe saying things that are extremely misogynistic and, you know, permeate through the school then. So really what the SPHE curriculum is about is, you know, giving educators, I suppose, a space and giving young people a space to talk through topics that they might be coming up against anyway, and creating that kind of inclusive environment in which that can actually be discussed in a supportive and safe way.
All right. Listen, Doreen, thanks very much for your time. I do appreciate it. That's Doreen Crossan, Women's Health Coordinator with the National Women's Council. Any views on that, let us know.